Welcome back to episode 264. Well, I know we missed last week, so but we'll catch up here.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I was under the weather.
Well, you said so every now and then you get sick. That's good. But you're on the mend and getting rest, and I'll try to be gentle with you tonight. So you
can... Yeah.
Thank you. Well, still in the news, still relevant, I think, was this political stunt by Ron DeSantis, probably one of the greatest political stunts I've witnessed in a long time. They accused him of, you know, just playing politics. Well, of course it was politics. That's what you call making a political point. Anyway, Governor Ron DeSantis, he sent illegal immigrants to beautiful Martha's Vineyard. I don't know if it's an official sanctuary city, but they do have signs adorning the city telling people that they're welcome to immigrants and all people, and love is love and all that stuff. A very wealthy and liberal summer resort town. He shipped two planes, almost 50 migrants to Martha's Vineyard, mostly from Venezuela, a couple of weeks ago on Wednesday, I think, and by Friday, the National Guard, I think as many as 300 troops were called up by the governor of Massachusetts to get them out of Martha's Vineyard and put them on a military base in Cape Cod. So the good people of Martha's Vineyard get much better service from the government than the people of Brownsville, Texas, or in El Paso, Texas. A wonderful, exposure of the hypocrisy of these limousine liberals that live up in Martha's Vineyard, including the Obamas, and also their lack of self-awareness in some of their statements, saying we just don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the resources, as if the working class people of El Paso, Texas, and Brownsville are just a wash in resources to share with the multitudes of immigrants and so on. Storm into the country. It was a great political stunt. It highlights the issue, also the hypocrisy of both parties on this issue. No one seems to want to do anything about it except increase the flow of people into the country to bankrupt it, to change the politics. You know, electoral strategy and also a demographic strategy that's being carried out throughout the world. So, Joe, what did you make of this political stunt?
Well, I loved it. It was, like you say, it was the greatest political stunt that we've seen. I can't even remember the one that that I've enjoyed more. The perfect hypocrisy of Martha's Vineyard's position is make the issue more visible. You know, when you do a political stunt, why? What is the point? I mean, it isn't just to to pique your opponent. You're really trying to sway the population to understand an issue that is hopefully something that'll work in your favor. And I just think DeSantis is ingenious for having done this. There's nowhere to hide on the thing, right? Martha's Vineyard can't accept these people in. You know, they have what I would call kind of a limousine lifestyle there. There's no place to put these people. And your comment earlier that they actually have more resources than the working class neighborhoods that are bearing the brunt of the replacement illegal alien insertion by the Biden administration. And so this draws attention to it. And hopefully, in the November elections, there'll be a reaction to it. I mean, that's why I think the stunt was so terrific, is that I could actually see some votes swinging over, to Republican, the Republican side, because the issue is clear now. There's nowhere, this, when you put it out in this way, it makes it so difficult for any kind of spin control on the thing. You know, it's just they are here, they're illegal. The Biden administration are letting them in, moving them around the country, and they're putting in places where there aren't enough resources to actually bring in and accommodate these people.
Yeah, every objection that you heard from the residents of Martha's Vineyard to the illegals arriving, obviously could be made by the people in Brownsville, Texas, El Paso, and some of the other border countries. We had one resident of Martha's Vineyard say, "We're not a border city." So it's like, well, evidently you are. I mean, you can fly them in, right? But I love, yeah. we're not a border city. I mean, obviously, so yes, some of these towns that are strained for resources, and by the way, are I think majority ethnic Hispanic. This is the Southwest. Their hospital systems have been strained and everything. And it is another sign of hypocrisy was the fact you people like Hillary Clinton and also Joe Biden saying you're playing politics with people. This is human trafficking. As this is his administration and the administration that he worked for, the Obama administration, flew the illegals into the country, dispersing them throughout small towns in Pennsylvania and Colorado. I think Minnesota since the 1990s has been enriched by 100,000 Somalis refugees. For some reason, the federal government
really no way to describe this as anything other than treason. This is an attack upon the nationhood of our country. Mm-hmm. Because they're bringing in people, illegal individuals, only for the purpose of destroying European culture and creating the great multicultural clump that will then vote in more, like Lori Lightfoot type Democrats. Mm-hmm. So that's the only reason for this, right? They're not bringing them in for any expertise. They are bringing them in illegally. And then to move them around the country cynically to shatter different, communities. So this is, I would just say, it's just, it's a war. It's just out and out warfare by the administrators of the Democratic Party against the rest of the United States. I mean, how else can you describe it?
Yeah, obviously these programs, we're not just dealing with Mexicans or from people from Central America. You have people from Pakistan and from Africa showing up on the Mexican border. There's a vast network, and it's paid for by NGOs, United Nations. They're giving money and resources to travel. This is how they're getting in such numbers. In the past, the United States had the benefit of distance, and now there's a vast NGO operation being carried out. Europe is suffering the same problem. And so all these people coming from around the world, these war zones that the U.S. has been involved with, now they're bringing them into the country. Somalia is a similar story. And the move by Governor Abbott and of Texas, he did a similar thing to New York and Washington, D.C., making the same point. Of course, at some point, the states will have to stop shuffling illegal aliens and confront the federal government. The feds who are derelict in their primary duty to protect the country's borders from invasion. But as you alluded to, the Biden administration's long-term electoral strategy is to, quote, brown the nation, thus diluting the white vote with an unrelenting stream. I think Biden's words when he was vice president of non-whites into the country, non-white immigration. Of course, this does conflict with Biden's primary responsibility, Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, which reads, the federal government shall protect the states against invasion. Now, an invasion does not have to be an armed force or a foreign military. It can be a disorganized brown horde coming in. And they've admitted it as such. This is replacement. Now, of course, this immigration crisis is a disorganized horde. It may look like that. You have caravans coming up equipped with cell phones. I think Carlos Slim provides it himself, and he's a Mexican oligarch or something, originally from the Levant. This immigration crisis is an organized affair, and it's afflicting the entire Western world, and it's being carried out by treasonous government officials, including our president, as I said, the NGOs, and the money power, transnational corporations. This is global cap. Of course, we've talked in the past about the organized Jewry and its role in this, and how they want to enrich the nations to create do away with majority ethnic populations, because that leads to a situation which the Jews don't find congenial, or they want to create diverse do away with the ethnic states of the traditional ethnic states of Europe, traditional countries, and they're dedicated to that.
So, well, wait, yes. They're not They're not going to dilute the ethnicity of Israel, are they?
No, that's one thing that's different. That's you know, that's the Israel difference, special nation. It stands above all.
Oh, I see. you know, and it's interesting how this plays out in, for example, Germany. I don't know if you caught the Green Party took over the city council in Hanover, and they immediately set up a kind of affirmative action with very aggressive standards. 1/3 of all jobs will be reserved for a diverse population. 1/3.
1/3.
Yeah, a third. They just said that you can't have.
Are there enough of them there for that?
Well, but the thing is that
I'm sure they'll be highly qualified, like in South Africa. No,
but this is, of course, insane because
or Jackson, Mississippi, for that matter.
Alexander Graf Lambsdorff, he's a white guy, German, and he said, "Well, this is unconstitutional, but what happens to the other 2/3? Are they reserved for organic Germans?"
Yes.
I mean, you can see the problems here because, it's really, what you're going to have is unrelenting immigration. And of course, the promotion of sexual inbreeding among the ethnicities.
Yeah, we see that with the German government actually promotes that with brown males on top of white women. Yes.
Yeah, that this is a social goal. And really, all you're dealing with here is kind of the authoritarian personality science, pseudoscience come to life. I mean, this is a 100% attack by the Judeo-Masonic sort of intellectual world against Europeans. It's just, there really isn't a lot of other ways of describing it. And it's interesting because here you can really see the end of the German ethnicity in, it's out there not too far in the future, because when you have this kind of draconian structure, where 1/3 of the jobs have to be for migrants, and you've got all these other social pressures, and then you combine it with all of the other problems. I mean, you're really looking at an incredible just swapping out of the entire German people over the next, maybe 10 years. I want to talk about the meaning behind the referendums in the Ukraine, because it's all part of what we're seeing here. But my point being is that you're going to have, in addition to this pressure on society from these unwanted immigrant groups that the EU authorities are pushing in, you're going to have a lot of just real hard-edged kind of like lifestyle problems, where there won't be enough food, not enough energy. And the real thing here, the elephant in the room, is the vaccine damage. So this winter, you're going to have this social circumstance just weighing on the culture, where you've got, just the hordes are going to be brought in for the purpose of replacement. And at the same time, the indigenous population will be sick, starving, weak, cold. I'll mention now, they have the referendums going on in the Ukraine. So you're having, I think it's 4 states that are going to have referendums, and they will be joining the Crimea as exiting the Ukraine. This is almost axiomatic, it's bound to happen. Now, this will set up a situation, Tim, wherein these regions will then become part of Russia. And now the war will take on a completely different character. It'll be much more violent. It'll be, because the Russians will, they've already said they're moving away from the techniques they've been using for the last 200 days, which many people don't know this, and I won't bore the audience with these details too far. But Russia really hasn't been running the war. I mean, they have been in the special military operation. Supposedly, they're letting the militias of the local areas take the lead in this and kind of determine the fighting style, and are just there for support. I don't think this is true, but this was how they were characterizing it. But once these regions become part of Russia, you know, they now have the call up of another 300,000 troops. And so I'm sure their intentions are to just completely eviscerate any Ukrainian forces in these regions. Now, if the Ukraine appeals to NATO for membership and says, here's our boundaries, and they've been taken over, I think you can see what is in store for us, wherein there will be regions that both NATO will either have an entangling commitment to defend, and certainly a region of Russia that is now going to be defended as part of the nation state. So as we talked about, 8 months ago, you're going to have a never-ending warfare situation. And I predict that there's going to be not just an incredible escalation in the fighting, but there'll be some event that will be a distraction. Maybe a low-yield nuclear weapon will be used, or maybe a Chernobyl type event or something like this that will be a distraction, because the fact is the all causes mortality is continuing to increase, and I'm sure that you add to the damaged immune system the effects of like cold and hunger, and you're really going to get to start to have huge die-off numbers in Germany and Austria. And so they, rather than let the population focus on the root cause, which is the vaccines, they'll have these distractions that will focus it on the war. And then, of course, they will have the fighting will be so intense, and perhaps a nuke has gone off, the sanctions aren't obviously coming off ever, right? So they're just, the German and Austrian people will be told, this is just warfare, cinch up your belt, starve to death, die of illness, whatever you have to do to support the cause.
Well, yeah, the escalation or the partial mobilization that Putin ordered last week is a response to the ongoing U.S. support, which has prolonged the war. Otherwise, Ukraine would have apparently Boris Johnson, following orders from Washington, told Zelensky not to negotiate, thus prolonging the conflict. And so that's the strategy, to prolong the conflict. And then, of course, the dumping of U.S., the flowing in of U.S. weapons and mercenaries and these things. And I'm sure there's all types of intelligence service are being provided by NATO under the table to prolong the conflict. And so it's a war, an escalation that apparently those who are making policy want. Of course, it's not in the interest of the United States or Europe or even Russia for that matter. As we've talked about earlier, this is a conflict that was completely provoked by Washington by not making any diplomatic offerings or accepting any negotiations with Russia, which would have been just, okay, no NATO membership, which is a position Washington had anyway, and also stop NATO expansion and give Russia a security guarantee on her borders and her near abroad, which is completely reasonable. So this, the whole thing has been concocted. And the continued flow of weapons and the economic cost of this thing is just ridiculous. Billions here, a billion there.
It's also that the U.S. could have, of course, asked Zelensky to stop the policy of genociding the ethnic Russians in these four regions.
Well, the New York Times wasn't reporting on it, so it didn't happen.
Yeah, right. But I mean, Putin has a very rational motivation for his behavior. All of the provisions of the various Minsk agreements have been violated, and the ethnic Russians were actually being genocided. I think that this is almost beyond dispute at this point. So when he goes in to protect these individuals, he's actually the moral force here. And that's not something that the U.S. and the media will report on, but that is certainly what is believed on the Russian side of it.
Well, he's also a tool of Jewish oligarchs, Kolomensky. Yeah. And he's, you know, and they have a problem with Putin because the past policies, I think Crimea, it cost Kolomensky the bank that he was stealing from or something. Or some, so right, there's that. Yeah. And it's a Jewish government in Kiev installed that doesn't represent Ukraine, which is a vast majority Christian. But yeah, he himself. So it's, yeah, of course, U.S. policy was always devised by American Jews, you know, Victoria Nuland and such. So this is something, again, prolong the conflict. It's a pretext for more economic sanctions, which then put further strain on the economy and creates the energy shortage. It's just one crisis after another. We always have crises. People don't know this, didn't make much news, but on September 9th, Joe Biden signed the extension of the emergency decree that George W. Bush signed on September 11th, 2001. So we're still in that emergency. Now, I don't know if, you know, the main threat is swarthy Middle Easterners or now it's white Midwesterners. But anyway, we're still in an emergency. If unless you didn't notice, the war on terror is still going on. So,
no, it's just been,
and like the pandemic, Biden declares the pandemic over, but the emergency decrees supposedly responding to the pandemic aren't over, you see, because the emergency is different than from the reality. The emergencies have a life of their own, right? The decrees, the policies and all that, they take on a life of their own. So they got nothing to do with one another. Really? It's like, you know.
Well, I guarantee
21 years. Wow, we're still in emergency. And, you know, we're just going about our business. Yeah. Grilling, watching sports.
COVID is rising very, you know, the cases anyway are rising strongly in the UK. And we're usually a month or so behind. So it's just going to, come back.
Well, isn't cold and flu season coming up? I mean, November.
Yeah. So you can, when that hits, you're going to have like a huge rise. And I don't know about the lethality of it, but I mean, in terms of the, infection rates, they're going to explode. And
well, I understand hospitals are now doing ads that say they treat children for myocarditis.
Yeah.
So they're turning that into a business now. But don't worry, we have treatment for it.
And this is the problem here is that, you look at a vaccinated versus unvaccinated individual.
Mm-hmm.
If you contract COVID and you're unvaccinated, you might suffer between, couple hundred million and I don't know. I've seen estimates of like as many as a billion of these virons, the spike proteins traveling around. It's a lot, does a lot of damage. It's a hassle to get over. If you have a booster, Tim, you've got up to 130 trillion of these things circulating inside your body for a period of time. And of course, as we know now, they don't just disappear after 2 days. So since the spike protein is a registered toxin, you had better believe that when the vaccinated get reinfected, which they certainly will, every time they do, they have potential for just catastrophic illness. Now, Boria, the Pfizer CEO, he admitted that he had tested positive again for COVID, like Biden. You recall he got sick with COVID like a month ago. He had Pavlovid, and he was so grateful for the fact that he'd had the vaccine because it made his illness less severe. Well, he just tested positive today again. And I think this is mainly rubbish. I don't believe that this is real. What I think they're doing is they're just normalizing with famous people.
Was he sick?
No.
He's just getting tested. As long as you're testing for it, you're going to get positive tests because.
Yeah, but what I think they're doing is they're normalizing.
Because it's the nature of the PCR test to have the.
True. But they're normalizing reinfection so mm-hmm. that you can just get coronavirus after coronavirus, you'd be testing positive, whatever that means, but you just never clear it. And so your immune system eventually gets overwhelmed. And I think that's kind of the fate that many of the vaccinated people are going to experience. you know, there are therapeutics, but we've talked about this many times. If you've taken the vax, you had better start looking into therapeutics in terms of how to manage the vaccine damage.
Well, did you hear this past month we had Ken Burns came out with another documentary. This one titled The U.S. and the Holocaust, a three-part, six-hour documentary that was aired September 18th, 19th, and 20th. Now, I didn't see it. Like, I don't know if I can sit through it. I have better things to do with 6 hours. But the
what's the Holocaust? I've never heard of that before.
It's like it's an important thing. No, this is why it's more relevant. It's more relevant than ever, Joe. What are you talking about?
I forgot.
Okay.
The Holocaust. Oh,
The Holocaust. No, this one actually focuses on the United States, its reaction to its policies, and basically, the U.S. didn't do enough. So there's Jewish gratitude for you, right? I guess the United States Air Corps, along with the Royal Air Force, should have bombed more German cities. There were a few buildings left standing, if I understand, when the war ended. So that's what did it.
There were no buildings left standing. There were a few tiny villages with like, you know, kind of palm frond huts that was all that was left. Now, I know Burns is really funny because the idea that by bombing a few more, I mean, I forget what the number was, like 700 firebomb cities, something like this, that this would have helped somehow is really quite funny, because in fact, any clear-minded review of the last 6 months of the war would illustrate the fact that the firebombing caused the starvation and death counts in the concentration camps. You weren't helping anyone. You were actually bringing about whatever, you know, groups were dying inside the camps. It was because of the firebombing.
Well, that was the whole strategy of strategic bombing, other than the terror bombing, which they called it. That was actually a term they used. But one of it was to collapse the German economy, which actually they could have done without destroying the cities. They could have done that just by supporting, firing the rail networks and the or fuel production. That would have achieved the military objective of denying the German armed forces fuel and resources to fight the war. In fact, the Strategic Bombing Survey of 1946 actually included that the bombing actually prolonged the war. It killed, you know, a million people at least, civilians. And yeah, as you say, it did contribute greatly to some of the awful conditions that U.S. troops witnessed as they, you know, advanced through Germany, that camps like Dachau and Belsen and Birkenau, these camps, that Birkenau was in the east, but I'm saying Dachau and Bergen-Belsen, these camps. But it provided a lot of the footage and the dead bodies such that they could spin the narrative of the Holocaust and the Final Solution, which we've talked about. But nevertheless, in this, I think the focus of the documentary is to focus on America's domestic front reaction to the war. Apparently it was late in entering, too late. And also the role of, say, America First, like Charles Coughlin and the aviator Charles Lindbergh, and America was itself a nation of immigrants, but it was also xenophobic, apparently. So it didn't, because, you know, the story with the St. Louis, so they didn't let the Jews in on these things. So they're being blamed for that, apparently. America is at fault for not doing enough, I guess, whatever we make of that analysis. But what makes this relevant is that the week that he was doing this was also coincided with the political stunt by Ron DeSantis. And right. Ken Burns goes on NBC talk show, and I guess his interlocutor, who happened to be Jewish, somehow said, okay, talking about the Holocaust, and now we have this thing with the Florida governor and the migrants going to Martha's Vineyard. Are there some parallels here to the Nazis and Hitler? And I was like, what is this, going to Martha's Vineyard? I guess you could say, yeah, Auschwitz had a pool and sort of many houses on Martha's Vineyard.
I saw the exchange. It was just absolutely, it was like, you know, it's a combination of sophistry and completely brain dead. You know, there's just it was just shocking how incoherent the thing was.
Yeah, how was going to sending people to Martha's Vineyard in early September cruel?
Well, the Holocaust parallel is that we're sending people somewhere they don't want to go. even though the fact is that the immigrants really didn't know where they were going and were certainly happy to go wherever they were sent.
So, aren't they illegal?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
So that makes them subject to being rounded up and detained and sent somewhere, right? Right? Yeah. Am I wrong about that?
That wouldn't happen in Chicago after the Safety Act comes into effect.
No.
But yeah, in the old days, that would happen.
Did you see that one shirt? That one guy had a Ruth Bader Ginsburg T-shirt on.
Really?
Yeah, it was there being fed. They're being fed like dry cereal by the good people of Martha's Vineyard. And I don't know who was given the shirt. Just picked it up, but he was wearing a notorious RBG T-shirt. Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, "Well, look at this. Who says that? Yeah, like I said, who says they can't be assimilated? Just 24 hours, Martha's Vineyard. He's already a shit liberal." He's wearing a Ruth Bader Ginsburg T-shirt. This is amazing.
That is truly incredible. Yeah, it just shows you how they're able to assimilate so quickly these.
This analogy is the 300 or so National Guard coming in and scooping up these migrants and shipping them off to a camp in Cape Cod. Is that analogous to like the Germans and the SS and all that? Well, if you're going to draw that analogy, I'm just trying to ask
you, we've talked about this. It is the most central intellectual structure in Western civilization, and its entire purpose is to prevent thought. And that's what everything that has been programmed into Europeans about the Holocaust has the function of preventing a kind of critical thinking about World War II and about the relationship between Jews and democracy. I mean, I would think that I would say that even a lot of Jews would agree with that statement, right? So, but that's what you have. And so when you have Burns talking about the little immigrants going off to their Holocaust, I would say this, that we have to be, I don't know, maybe, but I sure hope we're at the diminishing returns where there are some people who start to laugh at this, that they will not, you know, they will see like Burns's line of reasoning as so obviously preposterous, right? And propaganda. They'll simply see it as propaganda. So they can laugh at him because there's really nothing that you can do with Burns's comment and his whole show other than just laugh at it.
Yeah, he lives in a town in New Hampshire that's 96% white, by the way.
Well, sure he does.
Yeah.
Of course he does.
So he has a lot in common with the people of Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
So I can see why he feels he has some affinity with them.
And they are doing everything they can to prevent Holocaust.
Now, funding for U.S. Holocaust was provided by, David M. Rubenstein. He's the one that's, that's making so many other monuments and Monticello woke by making a slavery tour. Judy and Peter Blum, Kovler Foundation, Gilbert S. Omen and Martha A. Darling, the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations, Gianna and Jonathan Levine, Jan and Richard Cohen, the Corrett Foundation, David and Susan Kreisman, Joe and Carol Ronald S. Lauder, Dr. Georgette Bennett, and the Dr. Leonard Polanski Foundation, and the
were all of these people a part of the group that produced the authoritarian personality?
I think at least they funded it. Their predecessors did. They're all either they're children or grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. So. What makes it relevant, though? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say I experienced the Holocaust just a week ago Sunday, or very close to it. In fact, it's what led to my illness. I was in Seattle, and we were catching a plane back to Santa Barbara, and the airport was in chaos, and the security line that we were in was shunted into this small area. And I mean, they may have had 3,000 people packed in cheek by jowl, and they had these cattle farm lines,
There you go.
And you walk past one another like 10 times. And that's where I got sick, of course, because, you're just breathing, I mean, like there was at least four or five people that were sneezing on top of me every time they would pass by me. So it was just, I was a sitting duck. But I was when I was there, I was thinking, gosh, this is just like the Holocaust. And I was wondering if I could, you know, kind of ask for reparations from the airlines, given the, you know, how we were treated like animals, you know, and just shunted into this area. I have one little anecdote for whatever it's worth. So I was there in the cattle pen for about an hour and 20 minutes. We thought we were going to miss the plane, but in fact, we made it. But at the very end, then when you finally reach the eyedropper where they shoot you through the thing and you go into security, you know, I never let them, I don't let them radiate me. I always ask to be pat down.
Now, this is relevant because we're still in a state of emergency from 2001.
I know we are. So my wife's the same way. So we're sitting there and they go, okay, just stand right there. And then a couple other guys after a few minutes didn't want to be patted down too. And then this person in a wheelchair comes up and they're trying to figure a way to get the person through the scanning thing. And it just isn't going to work. So this one person who is a TSA guy, and you can imagine what it's like at this, the people are just, everyone is, you know, in chaos at this point. The person looks at this little clump and he just waves us in. So we went through without any security at all. So after being in line for an hour and a half, at the end, we didn't even get scanned. The guy just said, just get it, go through here. And that was that.
His common sense prevailed at that point.
Yeah. So anyway, but there's... And then Thursday I got sick.
Yeah, it's because Ken Burns in some of these interviews, I've been reading some of these interviews, he's equating it to the current political environment now, to 1930s America, thinking of the America First Committee, those opposing, by the 30s, Europe wasn't at war yet, but there are those who read the writing on the wall. And some of the populist uprisings of the 30s, like with Charles Lindbergh and Father Coughlin and these things, he's equating it, Ken Burns, to a MAGA country. Of course, this is important because you have the rhetoric of Joe Biden. You have the Joe Biden administration who's in the Congress and the FBI and the Justice Department who's are weaving tales of, you know, of white extremism, which is complete fantasy. It's just a lie they're telling to justify their power grab and violate people's civil liberties. Joe Biden is talking about, you know, defending our democracy. Our democracy. What is their democracy? Apparently, it doesn't include free speech and right to free assembly and jury, you know, a timely trial and these things. So as he's accusing his political opponents of being, you know, fascist authoritarian, he's of course opposing his own authoritarian regime or policies on people. Biden's not out of control. He's just reading a script, a teleprompter, the extent that he can. I just recently there was a video going around. He gives one of his stupid speeches at the UN regarding Russia. I guess trying to pick a fight with Russia, making things worse. And after he's done, he starts wandering around the stage, like not knowing where he is. So he's not in control really of his faculties at this point. So the president.
That was a scary video because he did look very much lost.
You know? Mm-hmm. But one thing it's important is that the White House also hosted a United We Stand summit. Apparently, this was apparently in response to the Brooklyn grocery store massacre that occurred, where the shooter had a strange relationship with the Fed. So make of that what you will. But this they hosted a bunch of people. Merrick Garland was there, where he told people that the Justice Department was there to defend Black people from white people, of course. And you had, I think it was hosted by Susan Rice. The keynote address was by Joe Biden himself. And so this was just a big hating whitey session. And they apparently, again, they weave tales. And of course, they have all these experts about domestic terrorism, and they're all citing stats and figures they got from the Anti-Defamation League, which is, of course, an objective source.
Right. Well, isn't every Democratic event and function at this point just a hate whitey?
It appears that's the case, yes.
And is there any other issue that they have? I mean,
well, they've stirred a lot of trouble. If you look at the crime, they had the summit. Apparently, they're telling us that we're, you know, the country is in a grip of, you know, is being assaulted by white supremacists, which I don't know any, or I think no one claims. I think a white supremacist is just people who think that white people have interest, or their interest should be respected or considered by their government that they
want to vote.
Of course, we're in the middle of a huge crime wave that's largely driven by Black crime. I think New Orleans now is the deadliest city on the planet now. So they shot back up again. The same with Detroit, these cities, New York, with all types of massive, which the FBI doesn't seem to have any concern or interest in this massive nationwide crime wave, or sort of what went on in 2020. It's, you know, since 2020, there's sort of this interstate criminal operation known as Black Lives Matter and Antifa, funded by various foundations. Of course, we have the situation with George Soros, these prosecutors that are there, they're chaos agents, and they're stirring up a crime wave for whatever reason. But nevertheless, we're being lectured that it's white people that are the problem.
I mean, it's an exact parallel in Germany, where in Hanover, this is actually in Germany all over. They have foreigners responsible for over 40% of the total murders and 60% of manslaughter, even though they're only 10% of the population. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we've seen these are kind of similar to statistics we've seen in the United States, right? So there is the fruits of the unrestricted immigration. So there's no purpose for it. There's no economic reason to have these individuals.
Well, that's what this Ken Burns documentary. It says that the problem with the country is we needed more liberal immigration. And it goes into some of the immigration restrictions, the Reed-Johnson Act and the restrictions that were in place 1925 to 1965. Of course, the immigration law of 1965, which when it was signed, they promised it would not change the country's demographics. And all the politicians who signed it, who said it would not change the demographics. Now, if you say, hey, change the demographics, they call you a racist. It's like, wait. So, you know, of course, we talked about the Jewish role, organized Jewish role in changing the immigration laws and changing the country's demographics to change the country's politics and culture. And they're doing the same thing in Europe. But this documentary shows basically it restricted immigration in the country, which contributed to the catastrophe in Europe. You know, and there's no recognition, of some of the policies before the war that contributed to the outbreak of the war in 1939. Ken Burns himself said, you know, think about you're in Weimar Germany, and it's a cool hip place. Like, really, that's what it was. Weimar Germany is a cool hip place. I was like,
what degenerate?
So I mean, the degeneracy and the collapse, which led to Hitler coming to power, but there's no recognition, there's no ownership or responsibility for these things, because every time they get kicked out or attacked, it's always because people's irrational hatred of the Jewish people. There's no responsibility on their part, you know. And there, yeah, like I said, I'm talking in these collective terms, because we have to talk in these collective terms, and they talk in collective terms, you know, when they there is organized Jewry. If there isn't, explain to me the existence of Israel, the Mossad, you know, and AIPAC and ADL and B'nai B'rith.
Well, there has to be organized Jewry. Otherwise, how did they get every position in the intelligence departments in the Biden administration?
Yeah, I think 75% of their Biden administration is Jewish.
Well, how could that couldn't occur just by affirmative action, could it? So you have to have some kind of animating principle. So there it is, you know, they're organized.
Yeah, they're in control of the foreign policy.
And,
their
whole, you know, purpose is to keep us from doing the same. You know, we cannot ever organize. That's always racist. They must organize because they are under attack.
You can't even organize a community, because that is the seed for fascism, according to the authority.
Of course, yeah.
You can't even have a family. That's the seed of fascism.
Well, I mean, of course, that's, yeah. You know, well, you can, but it has to be multicultural, you know, so.
Yeah, and then you find out what's really going on here, like all this transgender stuff, and it's the Pritzkers and the foundations they fund, and the why is it that, you know, Johns Hopkins or the Children's Hospital are doing this? And look who's behind this. It's not just happening. Obviously you offer them, if you throw money at it and offer incentives, you're going to have people going along. Just like I was watching this, it was a medical conference, hospital medical conference about business. And they had some administrator, their lady there, some psychopathic woman talking about just how lucrative upper and lower transition surgery is for hospitals, how much money is to be made by doing these things. And there's no consideration of course, the ethical and moral implications of these operations to the people and the community that have to put up with these people. She was just talking about the money that was offered. Now, you think about it from the standpoint of medicine. We talk about the cost of medicine and cost of medical care, this relative scarcity of good medical care for people, and how much money is being devoted to this completely, elective, not unnecessary, to say the least, if not, I think, illegal and criminal surgeries are being devoted to this stuff. And then this one lady talks about how even conscientious objectors will not be tolerated who work at this particular hospital or the corporations that run these hospitals. So doctors can't even say, we're not going to participate in this. But she's just going on talking about the money to be had by this without talking about just how it's insane and also immoral. We live in a country now, except you're Joe Biden, who's talking about one of the things about Biden, talking about one of the ways that the Biden administration is defending our democracy is working with big tech to censor people. And free speech. So we live in a country now where children supposedly can decide to change their sex, but adults cannot be trusted with information they see on the internet. So it has to be curated and protected. Where's the sense in that?
Yeah, they had that kerfuffle at Vanderbilt, where they had released videos showing, the intimidations against anyone inside the medical profession who spoke out or against any of this stuff. And they actually had in some of the internal documents the idea of how much of a money it was, moneymaker for the institution. So,
you know why it's a moneymaker? And this is what the lady said. This is interesting because why is this lucrative? Is every transition person, are they rich? No, they're not paying for it. Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, mandated that insurance policies cover the surgery for policyholders. So guess who's paying for it? There's one of the reasons why your insurance premium went from $350 to $1,200 monthly after the Affordable Care Act was passed was covering things like this, elective surgeries like this. Well, entire insurance company, federal law is forcing money into this, not to mention sort of the foundation funding that comes from all these Jewish firms like the Pritzkers. But taken the law and they forced everyone to subsidize this deranged, degenerate, perverse lifestyle. I mean, it's right, absolutely, right. And this is federal law. Now you have the feds backing this up, the full force of the federal government. You have Biden saying, Biden was talking about this last March. He goes, we're going to do all we can to protect the dignity of those of transgendered elderly people. What are you talking about? Is this a constituency now?
It is. I mean, they're creating quite a constituency.
Elderly, what, octogenarian transgendered people? Is this what the hell? Well,
there might be one in the United States if they can create it.
I mean, this is the president of the United States. Supposedly this is like a serious man in a serious job. He's a clown.
Yeah.
They're all clowns.
I wanted to read. There was actually in that, the documentation that this one group put out, they have, they point out that Vanderbilt opened its trans clinic in 2018. And this woman, Shane Taylor, came to help oversee the transgender, process inside the hospital. And she said that she came to Nashville to get into the gender transition game. She emphasized that it's a big money maker, especially because the surgeries require so many follow-ups.
Business schools just produce these people? Is that what it is? Is like they kick out the people like sausage? What is it? Where they talk?
Yeah.
It is. So it is. The world is a business. What it is, it's just ebb and flow. It's gravity and inertia. It's love and strife. There's no morality or ethics or anything other values. It's all about being money.
That's what they want us to believe, but they have very clear agendas. I mean, if it was just total chaos, that would be one thing. They're trying to transform the sexuality of.
Well, I think at the top level, you have that sort of weird Judeo-Gnostic, assault on nature. But I'm talking about the people just money, money, money. Just
don't fit, I agree. You know. No, I totally get it, and I agree. It's like, how can they even function morally or intellectually? You know, it's just amazing that they've been.
Yeah, I was listening to an education. This was an educational thing. I forget what county it was, but they were talking about, and just kind of this disembodied lady's voice talking. It's like an online thing, and they're instructing teachers. Yeah, it was an educational course. It was so on, and how they're telling teachers now that gender fluidity and gender identity manifests itself like in the first and second grade, and it goes like even kindergartners. So now it's okay, and you have to affirm this if students start talking this way.
Yeah, well, I mean this is they have us at a point where our normal, kind of parental guiding processes and our intelligence are turned off. They have to get this far in terms of debased transgenderism, which is so anti-human. They really have been successful at turning off the minds of, a great many of the Americans and all, of course, and the media is gone. But let's face it, there is a reaction against this.
Yeah, then you're called a terrorist or a counter-revolutionary by Merrick Garland.
Well, and that's good. Again, it's diminishing returns.
Merrick Garland, the Czechist.
Yeah.
So, well, then just that his family's making money off CRT nonsense. Yeah. I mean, it's just a conflict of interest. I mean, it's there's no point in pointing out the hypocrisy of a commissar,
I wanted to give you an idea of how the future of Chicago is bright because of the entrepreneurial spirit that is emerging there. 25 people in Joliet who were convicted or facing drugs and weapons and violence charges were able to make bonds using PPP loans for fake businesses. I'm not kidding. So you can see that, just when you thought the entrepreneurial spirit had been crushed in Chicago, no, it's still there. I would say, just as a word of warning, get out of Chicago, get out of Illinois, but certainly Chicago. I mean, by January, when the bail, thing goes away, the so-called Safety Act comes into effect, that's just uninhabitable. I just can't imagine there won't be a real dramatic increase in violence. It would just shock me if there wasn't. So there's already so much violence. It's just not going to be safe. The city has to be abandoned. And I would also say, if you're in Germany and Austria at this point, you really have to start making some plans for what to do with this coming winter, Tim. It's just going to be a mess. And if you have a family, is it really viable there? It's not clear to me what, I mean, I know that I'm in touch with some people. They're making a lot of preparations, wood stoves and things, but
well, they have to start a fry corps and kick the greens out.
Yeah.
Well, it's that's like the exactly 1920s all over again, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that so 19, to organize,
like the 1919 Munich Soviet or something, they got to go in there.
How do we organize Munich Soviet? Because that's what we just have to at this point.
Okay, Joe. We're about an hour now.
Yeah, take it easy on my voice. I'll be back.
Give you a break.
In good shape. But thank you, Tim, for the discussion.
Okay, great. Get better. We'll talk later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.